Good morning. I'm just going to carry this very heavy podium over here. Only strong people can do that. That's totally not me. Good morning. How are you guys doing? My name is Doug Walker. I'm the pastor to students at our Jennersville campus, and so I'm happy to be here at Kennett this morning. And special hello to our people at Jennersville live streaming with us this morning. I love that I can be here at Kennett and still at Jennersville. It's like, this is crazy. I've never done this. This is really tripping me out. But I love that I'm here this morning. While I am the pastor of students at our Jennersville campus, I do get to work with our Kennett students every now and then. My brother, who's on staff here at Willowdale, he's also a part of the youth ministry here. He's only been in youth ministry for a few months, so he's learning the ropes, and that's okay. I'm here to help him. But it's fun. Every now and then, we'll do events together. We will bring the Jennersville campus together with the Kennett campus, and we'll do things together. And that's just been a lot of fun. So it's been fun to get to know some of the Kennett families and Kennett students here over the last few years. Well, let's just jump right into it. Anyone here a fan of, like, extreme sports? Like, you participate in them. I'm not seeing, like, any hands. Like, whitewater rafting, rock climbing, you know, like skydiving, base jumping, nothing like that? Okay, well then I'm going to guess that you're all like me and you just like to live. You don't like pain. You don't like the thought of potentially dying and getting hurt. That's like, I am not an extreme sports guy. Growing up, I just watched everyone skateboard. I never put on rollerblades. That wasn't me. I was just content sitting on the chair over on the side. So that was not my thing. One extreme sport though that I think is just insane, that there is just no way you could ever pay me enough money to actually do this, is spelunking. Spelunking to me is one of the dumbest things any human can do. Spelunking, if you don't know, it's basically just cave exploration. And it's not like a cave where you're driving on the side of the road and you see like a cave entrance and you meander in. This is like you are diving into the earth where there is no daylight whatsoever. And you're putting yourself in a situation where it's tight crevices and tight spaces, and that's just not for me. I'm an open field kind of guy. I'm not a tight space, like, potentially let's get crushed by this boulder guy. Like, that's just not me. And so spelunking to me blows my mind. So my only experience with spelunking is just what I've read and heard from people who have done it. And the people who have done it, when I talk to them, unanimously, one of the first things I always hear is they always talk about the darkness. Just how dark it really is. And what they say is we don't really know what darkness is until we've been in a cave. Because in a cave, there is no light pollution. There's no light coming in. The only light that's possible in that cave is from your headlamp. And so if you turn your headlamp off, it is like an all-consuming darkness. Last June and July, there was a headlining news story, international news story, where a young soccer team of 12-year-old boys went caving with their soccer coach, a 25-year-old guy. And they went caving, and they were exploring this cave system in Thailand. And while they were there, unbeknownst to them, the exit of the cave collapsed. And so as they're walking through this cave system, they're going towards what they think is the exit, but it's blocked off, and they don't realize that it was just collapsed. And so now they're trying to find the exit, and so they're trying to figure out where to go, and because it's dark in there and they don't know really where they are, they find themselves lost. And then, you know, fortunately the parents of these boys, they know where their sons have gone that day. They know that they're in the cave, but the cave system is so large, they don't know how to get in and where to find them. It doesn't seem like a hard rescue mission. Just find someone who knows the cave system and go in and bring them out. What made this, like, headlining news was the fact that it was a rainy season and there was a threat of flooding in the cave system. And scientists and experts had kind of predicted that it could take up to 4 months to get the boys out. What makes it worse is this was going to be like a one-hour excursion, like a fun team bonding experience. So they didn't pack food, they didn't pack water. So these boys are in this cave with no food, no water, and potentially flood waters just kind of taking them over. And as I followed this news story, I was just really interested and fascinated about what was going on. It lasted for 17 days for some of the boys. One of the scientists that was reporting on this whole thing said, now, while lack of water and food is a big deal, another threat loomed among them. And that was the fact that they were in complete and utter darkness. In the 60s, a French geologist did an experiment where he immersed himself basically into a cave system, and he had no contact with the outside world. I mean, food was given to him, but he had no idea, like, the people were there. I'm not exactly sure how that kind of worked out. But he cut himself off from light completely to see what the ramifications would be if he just lived in darkness. And they were astounding. I mean, like, he fell into deep depression. He lost track of time. What he thought was 1 month was 2 months. He was hallucinating. There were some deep emotional, mental, his psychological ramifications on his body. And that's what the boys were now facing in this cave. It was worse than the fact they didn't have food. It was worse than they didn't have water. There were some serious psychological ramifications threatening these young boys because they were trapped in utter darkness. They had no light to guide them out to freedom. They were just sitting in that darkness. And we are concluding our teaching series called Advent. What Jesus aims to deliver. We're going to conclude it today, and we're going to be looking at the story of the wise men, and we're going to see how Jesus aims to deliver guidance for the wandering. And we're going to be looking at the story of the wise men and how the star in the east has kind of guided them to where Jesus actually was. Would you stand with me as we read the word of the Lord? Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people Israel." Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too." After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. All right, so before we really unpack this text, I want to give some background and context of what's going on, because we really don't know a lot of what's happening here. A lot of specifics are not given to us in this story. Here's what we know. There's some wise men. And I don't want to, like, ruin your potentially favorite Christmas carol of all time, "We Three Wise Men of Orient Are." Like, I don't want to ruin the song for you. But we don't know how many wise men there are. We don't know. I mean, we know that there's three gifts, but I could buy three gifts for my wife. You know, like, that doesn't, and I'm one guy, right? So we don't know how many wise men there actually are. We just know that there's wise men. There's plural. So there's more than one. Could be 10. Could be 5. We don't know. There's a group of guys. We know where they're from. They're from, you know, east of Bethlehem. If we were to look at a map, we would kind of see geographically where they're from. Historians can assume most likely that these guys were from Babylon. Babylon, just based on these guys, their occupation, their wealth, and the fact that it's east of Bethlehem, it's safe to assume that these guys are from Babylon. This, if you were to walk from Babylon to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, it would take 240 hours. In, like, modern day, like, roadish type environment and situations, it would take at least 30 days to walk that, at least. And that does not take into consideration, like, burglars on the side of the road and animals trying to kill you. Like, this is probably a 30 to 60 day journey. This is a long journey for these guys. And we also know one other thing about these guys. It's their occupation. They're astrologers. But they're more than just astrologers. Think like modern day Harry Potter, Dumbledore, Gandalf type guys. Like these guys are like wizards. Like they like you know, foretelling the future. And one part of their job is to study the stars. That's what they do. And they look to the stars to get some kind of revelation, to get some kind of truth told to them. Like, what is the meaning of life? And so they study the stars and try to figure out, you know, how to find fulfillment and satisfaction from the stars. To be an astrologer at this point in time was not an easy job. It was a hard job to get. You had to have the right education. You had to be intelligent. And if you got the job, you made bank. It was a very lucrative job. These guys are wealthy. That's what we know. The other thing we know about is the star, but the star doesn't have any specifics tied to it. We don't really know a lot about the star. There's a lot of different arguments about the star. Some people say that, like, just based on history and recorded data, that maybe the moon and Jupiter just kind of, like, cross paths, and the star just kind of, this bright light just kind of emerged, or maybe it's a supernova, maybe a star just exploded, maybe it's a comet. We don't know. We don't know what the star is. But what the star actually was does not matter. What the star actually was doesn't matter. And what does matter, I think, is God's intent with using a star. A bright light in the midst of darkness. I believe that God was incredibly intentional by picking a star to guide these guys to Jesus. That he chose a bright light in the midst of darkness to guide them to hope. That's why there's a star. And throughout the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, we see God and Jesus kind of compared to as light. John 8:12 says this. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And so there's a lot of symbolization with Jesus being light. And this is the introduction to who Jesus is. God specifically chose a bright light in the midst of darkness to guide people from wandering into hope. So we're going to look at two main things here today. We're going to look at a light that guides and our response to the light. That's what we're going to look at here today. So let's talk about light and darkness. Light and darkness. What do we know about darkness? I mean, number one, darkness is the absence of light. That's what it is. It's just that is just what it is. It's the absence of light. Darkness doesn't exist if there is light. When I was a kid, we lived in a house. I have two older brothers, and so we have a family of five, and we lived in a fairly small house growing up, and my mom did an amazing job at keeping that house clean. I mean, according to a 5, 6, 7-year-old, clean. So take that as you will. I don't really know, but to me, it was clean. And if we had company over, we would clean the house, and it was never messy. It was nice and clean. What the company didn't know, though, was that we had a secret closet where we just threw all of our junk into. And if you were to open that closet, you'd have to, like, jam open the door because there's the hockey pads and boxes of Legos behind it, and you just have to, like, force your way in. And you would just see soccer nets and soccer balls and roller skates and hockey sticks just filled with all this stuff. Now, I remember at one point when I was like 5 or 6 years old, maybe 7, my mom gave me the job of cleaning the closet, which I thought was like, come on, I'm 5. Like, there's just no way this is happening. But I was pretty clever at this moment. And I'm pretty impressed with myself, actually. I opened the door to the closet and I forced my way in, and it is messy. And I think to myself, I'm never getting this done, and I don't want to do this. I'm not going to do this. And so I turned the light off in the closet, and the light that came in from the hallway, I decided wherever the light is hitting, I'm going to just move that stuff into the darkness where no one can see it. And the mess is there, but no one has any idea. And so I move it all around, and I'm like pretty satisfied. I'm checking it out, and 5 minutes has passed, and I'm done. I should have like stalled some more time so I could convince my mom that I actually cleaned it. But I then left the closet and started doing my own thing. My mom sees me and she goes, "Hey, did you clean the closet?" Like, she knows I probably didn't. I'm like, yeah, I finished it. She's like, "Oh, okay, come show me." I'm like, "All right." So we go to the closet, the door's open and it looks clean. And her hand reaches for the light switch, which I then have a small panic attack because I know that the truth is about to be revealed, that there is a huge mess in there. And she turns the light on. And of course, my mess is still there. The mess wasn't taken care of. But I tried to hide the mess in the darkness. And that's one thing that darkness does. It hides. darkness hides. And I think we do that as just human beings. We like to hide the messiness in our own lives, in our own hearts. We don't want our mess to be exposed, to be revealed, to be shown to anyone. And so we do all we can to just kind of hide it away from everyone. We don't tell anyone the things that we think. If everyone ever found out the things that I'm actually thinking about, they would think so little of me. If people actually knew the selfishness that is in my heart, if people actually knew the things that I said to my spouse, if people actually knew the stuff that I'm really looking at, if people really knew the stuff that I'm carrying, they would judge me and I'd be so embarrassed and no one would ever, ever like me. And so we take that messiness and we hide it in the dark and we just kind of put it back there where no one can see it because we don't want light to ever come into our lives and to reveal and expose that stuff. Darkness hides. The other thing that darkness does is it brings shame. As we hide that stuff in our lives, as we decide, you know what, I'm not going to let anyone know about this stuff. I'm going to hide it over here, and no one's going to ever know the embarrassing things that I've thought and said and did and looked at. No one will ever know that stuff, and I'm going to keep it in the dark. That's my messiness, and I can try to fix it on my own. And as we try to fix that stuff all on our own, we begin to carry an unnecessary burden of shame and guilt. A burden of shame and guilt that we're just placing upon ourselves because of our own rebelliousness against God. Because here's the darkness. The darkness is rebellion. The darkness is our sin. Because we oftentimes think that we can find good apart from God. That we can find goodness, we can find meaning, we can find value and fulfillment apart from Jesus. And so as we try to find that stuff, we inevitably end up doing stuff that we probably should not do and experiencing things that we should probably not experience. And those choices just kind of eat away at us and we try to hide it because we don't want anyone else to know and we end up just carrying this oppressive burden of shame and guilt. When the boys in Thailand were in that cave, the darkness was described as just being oppressive. Unlike anything they'd ever experienced before. And I cannot imagine what that is like. I don't know what that is like. But that kind of darkness is the kind of darkness that we willingly invite and let in as we keep our mess in the dark. We willingly let that oppression just sit with us as we keep that stuff hidden away. Here's the third thing that darkness does. Darkness makes us wander. Just imagine those boys in that cave. They're probably just overcome with fear. They're scared. They don't know what they're going to do. And so I'm sure some boys at one point in time, in that utter darkness, they probably got on their hands and knees because they don't want to hurt their heads as they kind of walk around. And they're just kind of feeling around, trying to figure out their surroundings, trying to find a way out, trying to find some sense of freedom. But there is no light. They cannot see. And so they are forced to wander. They are forced to wander. They had no light to guide them out. And so they are forced to wander. And in the midst of our own personal darkness that we create for ourselves, we just wander our way through life, trying to just kind of navigate the feelings and emotions of shame and guilt that we have. Trying to navigate, how do I get rid of this shame and guilt? How do I find meaning and fulfillment in my life? I'm trying to find it. I crave it. I long for it. But I end up doing stuff I probably shouldn't do. And I feel the shame and guilt for it. Darkness makes us wander. On the flip side, we have light. When darkness hides, light reveals. In the closet, I had my mess in there. I tried to hide it. I did my best to kind of push my mess more into the darkness where no one could ever see it. My mom comes in, flips the light on, and it's exposed and it's revealed. When we choose to follow ourselves and say, I can find happiness and goodness apart from God, we choose darkness. But when we say, no, I cannot find goodness apart from God, I need Jesus to find the meaning and fulfillment that my heart longs for. When we say, yes, I want light, Jesus comes in and he reveals the darkness to us. And he shows us the stuff in our lives that we need to get rid of and to make right. Light reveals the darkness. The second thing that light does is it brings freedom. Darkness brings shame and guilt, but light brings freedom. That if we say, Jesus, apart from you, I cannot find any goodness. I need you. We experience the freedom from our shame and guilt. And then, of course, the third thing that light does is it guides. Darkness makes us wander as we kind of navigate an uncertain, unknown territory as we're trying to figure out how to do life. We wander in darkness. But with Jesus, there is light, and that light guides us to hope. It guides us in a relationship to him. God was very intentional with picking a light, a star, because it introduces to us who Jesus really is. And now we see in this text, we see three different responses to that light, to Jesus. We see three different responses. We see a response of anger, a response of apathy, and a response of adoration. Let's look at the first one. Let's look at anger. We see anger with Herod. Let's read these verses together. King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this. This is referring to when the wise men had come to him and said, hey, do you know where this king is being born? He was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. I can unpack that a lot, but I won't because we don't have time. That's a big deal, as was everyone in Jerusalem. We didn't read verse 16, but if we continued in chapter 2, verse 16 has Herod's reaction to all this. Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. He sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, based on the wise men's report of the star's first appearance. Herod has deep anger and hostility to the fact that there is a new king coming. Think about this for a second. Herod is the king. If you're king, life is good. You get whatever you want. No one tells you what to do. You're the boss. You tell other people what to do. If you want, you know, grapes fed to you, you get grapes fed to you. If you, you know, if you want friends to come over, your friends come over. If you want all the money in the world in your province, you get it. You have a very cushy, good life, and you are the boss, and you get to decide what you do. No one else tells you what to do. You are the authority. And now King Herod hears about this king who's not just the king, he's the king of kings. And this king of kings is going to threaten his authority, going to threaten his ability to decide for himself what he can and cannot do. And when he feels that threat, he becomes so angry because he's losing his sense of control. And so he does something that is so just awful. I mean, this is genocide. He just kills babies 2 years and younger, all because his sense of authority is being threatened. And I think we can subconsciously respond in the same way. We like being the boss. We like choosing for ourselves what we can and cannot do. We like knowing that we make our own choices, that we can decide for ourselves. We oftentimes think of God as this cold, harsh, distant dictator God, just giving us rules to live by and taking away things that we want to do. Here's the things that you can do and can't do. And so why would we ever want to serve a God who takes away the things that we really, truly want to do deep down in our heart? And so Herod saw this as a threat to his authority. And I think sometimes we see that as God too. That despite Jesus offering us light in the midst of darkness, hope in the midst of hopelessness, redemption in the midst of brokenness, We sometimes say, yeah, but that's not worth it because I can't do what I want to do. I want to call the shots. I want to be the boss. I want to do what I want to do. And I get that. I've been there. I've experienced that. I felt that. And I know from personal experience, living like that, man, that just brings more shame and guilt. The next response we see is apathy. And we see this with the chief priests and the teachers of religious law. Let's read verses 4 through 6 together. Herod called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? So the wise men have gone to him and said, hey, there's this guy. He's going to be the King of Kings. He's coming. He's going to be born. Do you know where he's going to be born? And he goes, I don't know. Let me go gather the smartest people in the area. And so he gathers the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. These guys basically have the Old Testament memorized. That's like their job. The leading priests, those are like pastors. The top pastors around in that area. They know more about God than anyone. And the teachers of religious law, these Bible teachers, they're basically lawyers and they defend the Bible. That's their job. They know the Bible better than anyone. These guys know more about God than anyone probably in the world at this time. So Herod calls them and says, hey, where is this Messiah supposed to be born? And immediately they're just sitting there going, oh yeah, okay, there's a prophecy in the book of Micah. Yeah, and here's what it says. And then they say it to him. In Bethlehem, verse 5, in Judea, they said, for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people Israel. They're sitting there going, oh yeah, this is the prophecy of like Jesus coming one day. So he's here? Okay, cool. That's their response. It doesn't, after this, it doesn't say, so they immediately got up and went to Jesus. It just says that the prophecy has been fulfilled. These guys know so much about God, they don't know God. They don't know God. I am a humongous cheesesteak fan, and if any of my students in Jennersville are in the room at Jayville right now, they're probably rolling their eyes because, yes, I'm talking about cheesesteaks again. So I apologize. I often do in my teaching because they're just so good. I went to school out in Indiana. I grew up in the Philadelphia area in the suburbs. And I got out to Indiana and I discovered there's no cheesesteaks in Indiana. Not only that, no one knows what a cheesesteak is. So I can't even go anywhere and say, can you make me a cheesesteak? And this just blew my mind. And so I would just tell my friends about cheesesteaks and I would describe cheesesteaks to them. And I would say, man, you got to have the right cheese. You got to have the right roll, Amoroso, by the way. And you got to toast that roll just a little bit. And you got to have the right meat to cheese ratio. You got to cut the meat the right way. You got to have the right ratio of everything. And it's amazing. But all I could do was describe how good it was. Eventually, I convinced my friends to come home with me and check out Philadelphia, my junior year of college, where they finally took a bite of a cheesesteak. Before they had taken a bite of a cheesesteak, they just knew a lot about the cheesesteak. They had heard about the cheesesteak, and they could probably rehearse my speech about cheesesteaks because I had said it so many times. But now they've actually taken a bite, and they've experienced it, and now they're the biggest advocates. They were like, oh my gosh, you were right. This is amazing. But until they took a bite and experienced it for themselves, they didn't really know what a cheesesteak was. They just knew a lot about it. And that's the problem with these guys. They're apathetic in terms of their relationship with God. If apathy has a word, if it's defined as one thing, it's just like kind of like a meh. That's apathy. How's life going? Eh. You know, whatever. It's whatever. How's your relationship with God? It's whatever. And one thing I've learned about our relationship with God, it's either you are constantly, day by day, pursuing a meaningful personal relationship with God, or you're not. The Bible has a lot to say about this feeling of apathy. Let's look at Revelation 3, 15 through 16 together. I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were either one or the other. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I am about to spit you out of my mouth. I mean, think about that for a second. You're neither hot nor cold. No one likes a lukewarm beverage. No one's outside working in the hot sun, going inside, you know, looking for a room temperature glass of water. That's not refreshing. No one goes to Starbucks and says, I want a tall, flat white, make it extra lukewarm. Like, no one wants that. Lukewarm is not a good thing to have. And if the chief priests and teachers of religious law can be guilty of being apathetic in their relationship with God, so much so that when the fulfillment of the prophecy of Jesus coming to earth does not move them so intensely emotionally to go from where they are and meet Jesus right in that moment, then we can be guilty of it too. If Jesus showed up and he's at Filter right now in Kennett Square grabbing coffee and we found out, I think a lot of us in this room would go, oh my gosh, that's amazing. The timing just really stinks. Because I got like a lacrosse game my son has to go to, and we have company coming over tonight. I got to throw a chicken in the oven, so let me do those things first. And then we'll go and we'll see him. I think a lot of us are guilty of being apathetic when it comes to our relationship with God. That we're either hot or cold. And we accept this state of just being apathetic. Let's look at the third response, adoration. These are the wise men. We see adoration with wise men. Let's look at verses 9 through 11. And the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Let's just think about this for a second. These guys are astrologers. In the Old Testament, if we look closely at the Old Testament, anytime astrologers are mentioned, they are directly connected with being pagan sinners. Like, these guys are not God worshipers. These are like the least likely to come and to know God. And yet, one of the first groups of people that God reveals himself to through a star that brings them to Jesus is a group of pagan sinners. This star is in the sky, and it is so compelling to them that they feel like, I must go and follow this. I don't know what it's going to lead to, but I know that there is something different about this. There's something amazing about this that is going to radically change our lives. They get up and they start their journey, their 240-hour trek across the desert. I feel like by hour 10, I'd be like, okay, I'm really tired. And to get home is another 10 hours. This is a 20-hour thing. I have a thing to do this weekend. I need to get back home. But these guys are driven by such amazing faith in this moment that they make the journey to Jerusalem. They don't know where the baby is yet. They don't know where Jesus is yet, but the star leads them to Jerusalem, and they still have another 5 miles to go to get to Bethlehem. They get to Bethlehem, and they meet a baby. A baby. But that experience meeting Jesus was so incredibly life-changing. They knew for certain that this was truly the King of Kings, where our hope would be found, where our sense of fulfillment would be found, our sense of meaning would be found. They knew that in that very moment, and their reaction is worship and adoration. And they give these expensive gifts in response to that. Ephesians 2, 8 through 9 says, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith." That's what these wise men had. They had faith. Where are you in that? What is guiding you right now? Are you being guided by your own darkness, wandering through the darkness, trying to figure out how to deal with the mess of the decisions and choices of your life, trying to hide all that stuff? Or have you chosen to follow the light? The light that guides to hope, to meaning and fulfillment, to restoration. Because that's what Jesus does. Jesus brought restoration to the broken. He made right what was wrong, and he healed what we hurt. What are you following? And what is your response? Are you unwilling to hand over authority? Are you apathetic and you're just like, this is what it is. I know a lot about God. I don't know God. Or maybe you're like the wise men and you truly have found Jesus in a personal, meaningful relationship with him. I'm going to close with a quote by a guy named J.I. Packer. He's a theologian. He's written a bunch of books. One of his books is called Knowing God. How do we know God? And he describes this idea that I think a lot of us in here are like this, where we can know a lot about God. And we can observe him, and we can kind of look at him, and we can know a lot about him before we really know him. And here's what he says. We are in the position of travelers who, after surveying a great mountain from afar, traveling around it, and observing how it dominates the landscapes and determines the features of the surrounding countryside, now approach it directly with the intention of climbing it. Maybe you're observing God from afar, and he's just amazing you in so many different ways. But you haven't made the decision to go and climb that mountain and to know what it's really like for yourself and to experience it. I hope that you choose to follow the light instead of darkness today. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for your intentionality with choosing a star in the midst of darkness, a light in darkness to guide these wise men to you. Because God, that's who you are. And this story just reveals your heart that it doesn't matter who we are, it doesn't matter what we've done, you desire to guide us to your hope and to your meaning and to your fulfillment in a personal, meaningful relationship with you. God, I pray that you would remove our anger. May we step aside so that you can step in and have all authority in our lives. God, may we not just settle for a subpar relationship with you. May we pursue a personal, meaningful relationship with you that we may bow in adoration and worship to you. Amen.